Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by all of our regular hosts, Drs. Scott Keith, Rod Rosenblatt, and Adam Francisco. We are continuing something we started in end of May or the beginning of June. Hard to remember exactly when this episode came out, but we started doing each of the books within C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. So we started off with The Case for Christianity, which we explained functions both as a standalone booklet that can be given to people, but is also the first book in Mere Christianity and functions as an apologetic. And we outlined that, and it was really kind of a popular episode, along with our episode on C.S. Lewis, which I think just our general episode where we covered C.S. Lewis is the most popular episode we've ever done. It's, I think, the most downloaded, which is pretty incredible. It must just be searched a lot. I mean, we have talked about him as probably, you know, the greatest Christian thinker of the 20th century as far as impact, especially within the realm of Orthodox Christianity. And so that was a popular episode. And so we decided to tackle Mere Christianity because we've talked about it so much on the show. It's made it into every book recommendation episode. It was sprinkled throughout the apologetic series. And now we're just going to kind of break it down. So today we're going to do book two of that, which is titled What Christians Believe. And before that, I just wanted to remind everybody that Thinking Fellows is part of the 1517 Podcast Network. We're a network of now 10 shows that produces just under 10 hours of audio content a week for people to digest, which is just absolutely fantastic. I can't believe we continue to be able to do this week after week. And it's thanks to the support of listeners. It really wouldn't be worth it to sit here and record for hours at a time, except that so many people listen to the show and reach out to us and say that it's been helpful to them in one way or another. All of the shows, you know, cover different different topics, but the core belief is that you should be doing something that brings people back to the gospel of Christ in some way or another. And that's the hope with the podcast network at 1517. If you enjoy what we've been doing, you can support the shows by donating to the network at 1517legacy.com/donate. There you can say that the reason you're donating is because you've listened to the podcast and you want to continue to support these shows and the development of these shows. And we really do appreciate it. The Thinking Fellows were very happy to be able to raise enough money to continue to do this show and add new content every year. It definitely, and as we add shows, some of those expenses increase as our hosting solutions and things like that, as we have more and more audio become more complex. So thank you for making that possible, both with your downloads and your donations. Okay, today we're doing C.S. Lewis, What Christians Believe, Book 2 of Mere Christianity. It's following The Case for Christianity, which, as we talked about last time, is, you know, setting up a basic apologetic for the Christian faith. And perhaps we just give a little more background. Why would this is essentially moving into the basics of Christian doctrine in this from the apologetic? Why is that the next step in this kind of book? And we've talked about the radio series and things like that. And perhaps, Rod, you can talk about maybe why this makes sense as a transition.
Well, if a person has read the first book, which all these were published on their own originally, some publisher, Macmillan in England, decided to glue three of them together, need to know that. If a person's gone through The Case for Christianity and said, I think, as Lewis laid it out, I think I'm beginning to be convinced that Christianity is actually true, then it's not a far cry to say, let us tell you what the content is. You might have some reservations, but he's going to lay out some of the basics of it, and as Lewis always does, in street language. He's a master at translating difficult thought into simple sentences.
I think one of the things that you realize after reading The Case for Christianity is that what Lewis is able to convince the reader of, I think very well, is a sort of universal conception of morality, of right and wrong. And the second part is that you, the reader, you don't live up to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so if you read The Case for Christianity, you're very much at this point of, I know that I need something else in order for things to be okay. And in the second book here, the details of that something else are very well laid out.
Yeah, I think, too, if you're going to set up that there is some truthfulness to be had within this religion, then the question is, so what are the truth claims of that? And that's what Christian doctrine essentially is the various claims at truth that the Christian religion makes.
Yeah. Sometimes it's helpful to get the view from 30,000 feet. The chapter titles are, 1, The Rival Conceptions of God, 2, The Invasion, 3, The Shocking Alternative, and 4, The Perfect Penitent, and 5, The Practical Conclusion. That's table of contents stuff.
Yeah, so each one of these books gets broken down into chapters, and that makes sense based on the fact that they were originally separate publications, right? That they would have even more sections within there. So yeah, so the first thing he's going to do is, now that he's kind of shown Christianity within the realms of human logic, he's going to put it up against other religions of this world, right?
Yeah, that's a great intro, too. Something no Christian has to believe. Mm. That all the other religions are totally wrong.
Yeah.
What a great intro paragraph.
Yeah. I mean, he goes at the idea that there is no truth out there, you know, in any part of any other religion. In fact, he sort of gives a little bit more credit than that. He says there's each one of these has found a part of the truth.
Uh-huh.
The problem is they haven't found the whole truth.
Yep.
Right? The whole truth is not in there. He acknowledges throughout there that there is only one right answer. That answer is reliance on Christ alone, of course. He points out that some of the wrong answers...
That's a great one, too.
...come close and are righter than others.
Yeah. You have to think analog here, not think binary.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting because we just talked about this on another recent episode. We are always often focusing on the exclusions, exactly what's out. And, you know, the good thing about this is to try to see how close you might be. And then again, in an apologetic sense, that's probably a good starting off point to say,
sure,
you probably don't need to attack the, you know, the Hindu here, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the point is you should move to Christ quicker,
mm-hmm,
right? Because we share some of these moral values or what have you. But there is something we don't share, and that's what you can move to quicker.
Yep.
So rival conceptions about God, I think that kind of makes sense from its namesake, right? We're going to talk about this. In addition to the world's religions, he does get into, we do this on the show sometimes, we do this comparison between Muslim faith and Christianity. He does that, the Jews, the Muslims, and the Christians, right? Do they all share the same God?
No.
Yeah, that's the basic answer, right?
Although, as they say, it's a little more complicated than that, but the short and skinny is it's no.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, and so that's a helpful section. I think it's like foreshadowing into our world now. That's kind of a big deal now, is everybody wants to make all religions the same, but even if they can't get you there, they'll at least say, well, why don't Christians and Muslims get along? You guys share the same, you share the same God, and... Mm-mm. This is a helpful section to get through.
He's got a little piece on atheism, too, which I think is...
That's his main shtick, right?
Yes.
That's what he's primarily going
and
after.
And he also very much respects pantheism.
Yeah, didn't...
In a way that I wouldn't have guessed.
Yeah. Didn't he call it a manly religion or something?
No, it was
Hinduism?
Zoroastrianism.
Zoroastrianism, okay.
That was a very masculine alternative.
Strange.
Because the battle-iness of it?
Yeah.
It kind of makes sense.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is an emphasis on war between light and dark, good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
I think this first chapter is important, and it's not like it's out of the... It's something innovative. You know, I was reading Acts 17, in particular Paul at Mars Hill, not too long ago, and I'm always struck in that little passage how Paul will quote, in the scriptures, mind you, pagan poets.
Yes. Yes.
And not to approve of them, but to say, hey, they're not entirely wrong on this
right.
point. He's is a springboard or
right.
some sort of common terminological basis.
Right.
So, because Paul, and I think the thrust of the Christian apologetic is not, it's not about replacing one system with another. It's about the truth of the gospel.
That's right.
And I think sometimes
in fact, the problem might be the systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think sometimes Christianity is kind of treated as a system of thought. Yeah. You know, we use the term worldview, which is can be taken too far, and but it's about the truthfulness of God taking on human flesh, dying and rising for our sins and our justification. And that kind of frees you up to start in all sorts of different places.
Well, it frees you from a lot of false fights.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you're also not trying to construct a theory of everything. In
yes.
Sense, which is,
let
I think,
the Reform do that.
Which is what I think a lot of other even theological, quote-unquote, systems end up doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go beyond what can actually be known from the truth of Scripture into conjecture and philosophizing, and pretty soon you have a system of the theory of the universe that is, quote-unquote, Christian, mm-hmm. But that is maybe, you know, what can you know from the Scriptures? That's what's Christian thought.
I think back
beyond that.
I think back when I was in college and I was agnostic. I thank the good God that somebody didn't come to me with the ontological argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
really.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You taught me that argument years ago, and this is hyperbole a bit, but every other day, one day I think, there's something to that argument.
Yeah.
The next day I'm like, eh. Sounds like smoke and mirrors.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a word game, really.
Well, yeah, I would have recognized
today.
That as an agnostic. You know, I think that there's something going on here. I'm not a major in logic, but there's something going on here that I need some help with because there's something down in the basement I know I don't agree with.
That'll be my feeling tomorrow.
Yeah.
But today I'm with you.
That's funny.
Okay, so then we move on to chapter 2, the invasion, which is interesting because I think it gets into the foolishness of Christ and the foolishness of the Christian religion.
He starts with the foolishness of what he calls Christianity in water,
mm-hmm.
which you and I would call Protestant liberalism.
Yeah.
Moves it right off the table.
So what is Protestant liberalism, Rod?
Well, Machen's Christianity and liberalism is the complete intellectual overthrow of the whole caboodle. Norman Vincent Peale, all of the ones who were always adjusting to their culture, that characterizes liberalism. Mm-hmm. You know, if whatever's hot in your culture, Christianity is that. Machen overthrew the thing in one book.
How about, would it be fair to say just as a sort of nugget answer that Christian liberalism is Christianity without anything miraculous
yes.
attached to it.
Yes.
So you don't need an actual incarnation.
Yep.
You don't need actual miracles. You don't
nope.
need an actual resurrection from the dead.
Correct.
You don't even need actual historical events in there eventually.
You're basically good, and you just need a model to follow.
Right. Right, which is interesting because if you back up, I mean, Lewis on the in the first chapter on rival conceptions of God, when he's going over what the atheist might ask, he acknowledges that one of the biggest questions from the atheist is sort of what we might call the problem of evil or
yes.
derivation of it.
Yep.
If God made the whole world, and you could maybe put in brackets there that he didn't put in, and God is all good, take the brackets back, and why have things in the world gone wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or why did my mom die in a car accident or something
yep.
like that?
Yep, and it will come up.
Yeah, so the funny thing is I think he acknowledges the main question from the atheist has to do with sin in the world.
Uh-huh.
But the main problem with Protestant liberalism is a denial of sin in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. So he gets that one off the table almost immediately. Then he says, makes the claim there are only two views that face all the facts. The first one he lists as the Christian view, and the second one, dualism or Zoroastrianism. Those are the only two he thinks that are worthy of a person fighting mentally about.
Right, and dualism makes sense if you're dealing with an individual who does acknowledge the evil in the world.
Yeah.
Right?
So, yeah.
That makes a lot of sense.
I didn't know there still was a Zoroastrian church, but there is.
Mallinson finds them all the time. I don't know. He's got a talent for it.
350,000 Zoroastrians in the world. Freddie Mercury of Queen was one of them.
Oh, my gosh. What?
But most, they originate from Persia.
Yep.
And most of them have fled because of the persecution at the hands of Muslims. Surprising.
And then the third major part of this chapter is he distinguishes between the two, the differences between Christianity and dualism.
Well, mainly one of the main ones within Christianity is you may even conceive that you're dealing with two powers, but these powers are not equal.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. Which is where in dualism, power of good, power of evil.
Who knows?
Yeah.
How it'll turn out.
Yeah, because they're equally
matched. Balanced. Yeah, it's up for grabs.
Yeah, you can think of Star Wars, Force, I think. You know, the Matrix mm-hmm. does a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Popular literature does dualism constantly, basically, mm-hmm. right? So, I think he uses that as an example.
Star Wars?
No.
the literature in his on myth, right, is the different one of the differences between Christianity and myth.
Yes,
being this dualism.
And Tolkien helped him sharpen that.
Yeah.
Sure. Even within myth, the ultimate good power is always, you know, more powerful mm-hmm. than the evil power, even though the evil power might win the day for a time.
Yeah. Yep. So,
yeah.
It's a good distinction.
As a background question, because anything after 1648 isn't relevant to me.
Yeah.
what's going on at Oxford and Cambridge where dualism, Zoroastrianism, and they're aware of all this? Anything? Is there like a resurgence in Eastern?
I don't know that specifically. When you read Lewis, you know, biographies of Lewis and Tolkien, or you know, even Surprised by Joy, Lewis himself. I mean, there's what's going on at Oxford in his time is just a rampant denial of anything.
Right. Yeah,
and positivism and the
campuses were going out to listen to presentations of that moral movement that took place during Lewis's day. I forget the title for it.
Oh, his friend, one of the Inkling, was part of it.
Not his lawyer.
No, I'll find
it. Owen Barfield. But he makes mention of that the students were getting a full dose of that in places other than their own campus classes.
Hmm.
I forget the name of it.
I think Barfield was a part of it.
He was an anthropopathist. He added that too.
Yeah. What could have been going on, Adam, and I guess this is conjecture, but it seems to happen all the time, is that when Christian cultures reject Christianity, they tend to be open to almost anything but.
That's pure Chesterton.
You know, and I think was probably certainly going on at the time. They're certainly going on for us, right? I mean... Mm. I think that all the time with sort of the liberal culture's endearment of Islam over Christianity, mm-hmm. you know, which is bizarre to me. It's just, for me, that's just bizarre. I don't understand.
Especially if you're tacking on things like
moral rearmament.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the movement. And Lewis does give it a paragraph or two because it was very active in his time.
Yeah. Mm.
Moral rearmament came from the States, if I remember correctly.
Or anything, and you could even go with his chronological snobbery, anything we're embracing now must be better than what we embraced in the past.
So it's just this, so they've left Christianity behind, so there's a big vacuum.
Yeah. Yep.
And they're, but you can't just float around
in
a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum, so you latch on to anything that's not Christian.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, what Chesterton said was, when a culture leaves Christianity, it doesn't turn into utter unbelief. It believes anything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Just interesting. Zoroastrianism is such a minority religion. That's the one he would call the manly religion.
Yeah.
It's strange. Or maybe it's philosophically he's thinking about the possibilities.
I think so.
Christianity or dualism, and Zoroastrianism is a...
Good candidate.
The classical expression.
Well, if you've come to be a believer in sort of universal sin or evil, what world religions are left for you as options?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've
not a lot.
And he and, you know, he and Tolkien come out of World War One. Yeah. They're part of that generation. Yeah. They saw that. They served. They saw the death. They saw the destruction. They saw the maleficence. They saw everything.
Killed a whole generation in Europe.
Killed a whole generation. And so if you've come to believe in this idea of universal evil,
I guess
there's not a lot of religions left.
Really. Any options?
Yeah.
Most Eastern religions have no way
Buddhism,
of solving
Hinduism
this.
Are out.
And if you've rejected Christianity, you're probably throwing out the moralism of Islam and Judaism as well, which is probably why he dumps them together in that little section.
But even Islam is explicit in its rejection of any sort of original sin.
Yeah.
Right.
So, interesting.
Hey, we're at time for our break, so we're going to go ahead and do that now, and then we'll come back and finish up the remaining chapters. Hey there, and welcome to our break. Today, I'm going to talk about the 1517 Academy, which is not necessarily a brand new project at 1517, but it's young. And what it is it's a set of semi-formal lectures that you can take online from 1517 on various topics. And the first course that we've had available in here, and one that I would absolutely suggest, is Dr. Rosenblatt's lectures on Luther's commentary on the Galatians. And we offer this for free on the 1517 Legacy site. So you go to 1517legacy.com/academy, or you can go to the main page and press the Academy tab there. And it'll take you to where you can activate the course. Basically, you give us your name and your email address, and you'll be sent the link and the login to the course. And what you'll get is a set of lectures broken up, and then there'll be some questions on there too. With you don't get like a A or B grade, but it'll basically have some basic questions that you can choose to answer to see if you got the basic material of what was in the lecture there. And at the end of it, it just basically, there'll be a survey that says, did you enjoy this course? Would you be interested in ones coming up and things like that? And we're going to have all sorts of different courses. In fact, Dr. Francisco just recorded a course in Texas on apologetics that'll be going up on here pretty soon. And that's
and Islam.
And
ten lectures and I think 36 hours.
That's wow. Right.
So I think you'll definitely want to sign up for the Academy now. So if you come and you take this Galatians course, you will get notifications when new courses arrive. And, you know, the podcasts are a great way to begin learning. We usually, in the 40 to 50 minutes that we do this show, we give you as much of a brief introduction as we can. We've compared it to like doing the very short introductions, right, that OUP series.
It seemed to me that the lectures that several of our guys did at Faith Lutheran Capo would lend themselves to Academy.
Yeah. And so we're doing these as basically extended, versions of, maybe doctrine or things like that that you'd get on the podcast. So, for instance, we've done an entire apologetic series on this, which on this show. But I think Dr. Francisco's is going to be, an actual formal set of lectures with some questions to consider and answer in there. So it's going to be a fantastic resource. And again, it doesn't cost you anything but an email address, which I'm sure many listeners to the show already get the 1517 newsletters and things like that. So it's not going to add any more burden to your inbox or anything like that. So go and check that out, 1517legacy.com/academy. Or again, the 1517 main page, and click the Academy tab. All right, guys. So we're going to finish up this episode. We're in the latter half here, so we can kind of look at the breakdown of this. And we have a couple more chapters to do this. So the next chapter is The Shocking Alternative, which again, it's like he's getting narrower and narrower as these go down, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of the idea. And again, we've talked about this is sort of the idea with apologetics, right? Is you are driving towards Christ and taking as little pit stops as you can. And that's kind of why we've tried to take time to explain why Lewis is stopping at certain points or not, right?
This one, he's going to set the children's teeth on edge if they're Lutheran, talking about free will. Mm-hmm. I wish he had talked about Adam and Eve having free will and the rest of us not, but this isn't how he wrote.
Yeah, so you want to dive into that a little bit? I mean, we've done Bondage to the Will type stuff on here, but you know, we're happy to critique people on this show. So where do you think Lewis goes right and wrong here?
Well, when he's talking about Adam and Eve, it's classic. That is, they did have free will. There have only been three human beings with free will in the history of the race. Three total. But he singles out Adam and Eve as having the ability to go right or wrong, and that's biblically sound. I'm not in that position. You're not, nor anybody we know, but Adam and Eve were. Blank slates. So he speaks of free will as if Adam and Eve's progeny also possessed some level of this. Now, it's only fair to say the Reformers, when they talked about free will, were not talking about whether to marry, whom to marry, what to have for dinner tonight, whether you're determined to have chicken. None of that interested them. But they were very interested in, could you cooperate with God's offer of Christ?
See, I read this, and I think that perhaps Lewis isn't dealing with the categories in the same way the Reformers were.
Oh, I think that's entirely possible.
I think the Reform, like if you take Luther and Melanchthon, they both knew exactly what they were talking about philosophically as well. This becomes clear when Melanchthon, you know, uses phrases like Manichaean determinism and this is not what we are and this type of thing. I think Lewis here is not making a clear enough distinction between what is your will, you know, what is the freedom or bondage of your will towards God and what is the freedom or bondage of your will towards everyday life decisions. Mm-hmm. And so he's acknowledging, of course, we have a quote-unquote free will in a sense, right? We make decisions every day that are ours and they're not determined for us. But his category is when you come down to like how one becomes a believer and how one gets faith and whatnot, he gets a little clearer there, I think, as far as that these things are a gift. I think one of the most interesting things is to the section on the shocking alternative is how it starts, because back in the previous chapter, the invasion, you get this sort of example of dualism, and in Christianity we acknowledge two powers, but they're not of equal power. And he starts this one out by saying that in Christianity the evil power has made himself the prince of this world, and then comma, at least for a time. And if you look at some of his other writings, like the Space Trilogy and or even just The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, you can see him do that in literary form too, mm-hmm. with the various characters in that, where there's an acknowledgement that there is a prince of the world who is in power for a time mm-hmm. until, you know, the God of all creation comes in and takes those reins back, right? And that this is a temporary thing. And I think that is too, one of the distinctives of Christianity, to you know, the acknowledgement that there's a fix to this situation, and even though it may seem like or even be that there is a prince of this world who has power in the here and now, this is not going to continue. Mm-hmm. So, and then he lays out the how and why it won't continue.
Yeah, and I think bringing up the free will question brings up, well, if free will made evil possible, is God guilty of evil? And
that's what he's going after.
And he deals with sort of that struggle there. And I think the good thing is he comes back to Christ and the positive possibilities of giving creatures freedom.
Yeah, well, you can see it too when he says we've been left even in after the fall with a conscience, a sense of right and wrong.
Yep, Romans 2.
We can never perfectly obey it. Well, there goes your completely free will. Yep. If you can never perfectly obey it, you do not have a perfectly free will. Yep. Otherwise, you could.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
He sent us, and then he goes into his ideas about, you know, the universal myth. He sent us good dreams.
Yes, even uses that.
Yeah.
And then along comes a Jew who speaks as if he has the right to forgive sins. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not just the ability, but the right.
Talked as if he was God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talked as if he was the person primarily offended by our sin.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it Lewis who says, it's one thing to say, I forgive you what you did to me last Thursday. it's something else for somebody to say, I forgive you for what you did to him last Thursday.
What you did to him offended me.
Yeah.
Is this the section where Lewis does the liar lunatic distinction?
The trilemma.
Mm-hmm.
He does have the section here about the absurdity of affirming that Jesus was a great moral teacher.
Well, this is where he says he was either this man was and is the Son of God, or is he is a madman or something worse.
Yeah.
One of the most often quoted paragraphs in all of his writings.
Yeah, and that's in this section, right? Yep. So that's when that pops up. And we've quoted that section before many a time on this show. So that's where that comes from for listeners.
Yeah, you cannot accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but not accept also his claim to be God.
Yep.
Right? That's common today. Jesus is like the great Boy Scout, right? Everybody says, I like Jesus because he's a great moral teacher. Or he's a great example.
But, I think that can only be true of people who haven't actually read the Gospels.
I know. I just think he's kind of rude. Like, he waltzes in, challenges religious leaders, tells people who have, studied the scripture their whole life, they don't know how to read it.
Yeah. Calls people names.
Flips tables. Yeah. Calls his mother woman.
Well, people like the idea of Jesus, but not the real Jesus of in a way that corresponds to who.
The way parables sometimes get set up too, and the way he says responds to people who don't understand.
Can you imagine dealing with the parable of the guys who come out to work at 4 and the first thing they do is take a coffee break, and then comes wages time and they get full wages?
Yeah.
If you were a businessman, that's crazy.
Right. Yeah.
You can't run a business like that.
Well, I even think of people who set up Jesus as the great advocate of the monetarily poor. That's a hard one to justify from the scriptures. His admonition is that the poor will always be with you. You know, to the person who's sad over losing his father, let the dead bury the dead. That type of thing.
Yeah.
For those who are oppressed by the government, go get that fish and take the coin that you find in its mouth and go pay your taxes.
Yeah.
Wish I could.
Yeah.
The other day I had my kids working in the backyard. I told my son who started working, I'll give you $5 if you help me all day. And then my daughter comes out about 5 hours later, and she says, Dad, can I work for you? I said, sure. Will you pay me? Sure, I'll pay you. And my youngest son, who had been with me the whole time, he says, how much are you going to pay Elena? I said, however much I want.
That's right.
Say $5 if she works the rest of the day. Then the other one comes out at 4:30. $5 if she works the rest of the day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you'll be pretty mad if you're the first one out there. That's for sure.
Yeah. Good thing Caleb knows because
he was probably always the first one out there.
Yeah.
I think the majority of today's people have never really bumped into the content of this chapter of Lewis's. Yeah. Not really. Don't go to churches where they would run into it.
No.
Haven't run into it in serious talk.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I sometimes, it's been a long time since I've read The Case for Christianity or Mere Christianity, but I sometimes wonder, why hasn't somebody done this for the 21st century? Is it because it can't be outdone? Because certainly that you can make some alterations to fit our context a bit more, but it's a marvelous, it's not systematic theology, nope. It's not a Christian philosophy, it's just, it's
we don't
one
all
of those,
write,
those
like
essential
C.S.
readings. Yeah. I would say, people are going to skewer me for this, but alongside like Small Catechism, read this.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. I think that's good advice.
When I was a pastor, the students had a Bible, Luther's Small Catechism, and the set of Narnia.
Yeah.
And I had Minneapolis call me to see if I would do that for Augsburg Publishing. I was already mad at them. So I set up something that I knew how they'd answer it. I said, I know about 5 guys who could do this alongside with me. Fly us regularly to a central place like Kansas City and pay all of our food and all of our booze.
That's funny.
The answer was, no.
I knew the answer would be no as soon as I added booze.
Yeah. Anything else we should do before we head on to the next chapter? which is probably
the last one, right?
Well, it's the second to last, but what it is it's the one where he really gets to Christ, full force.
The perfect benefit.
Yeah, and before that, the section, but suppose God became a man who could suffer and die, right, and yet was one person with God. That's the closing to the section we've been talking about.
When you open up with, he was not an evil, a lunatic or an evil person, so what was he?
Yeah. And so what do we... what do we get into here?
Well, you get into the theology of the cross, I would say, is that the main thing that he was and came to do was to suffer and to be killed for you.
Yeah, that's an odd occupation. What's your occupation? I'm a bookkeeper. What's your occupation? I'm a carpenter. What's your occupation? I'm here to die.
Right.
Well, and the disciples did not like that answer.
No, even when it was how far from Jerusalem, they were still saying what Peter said, or whispering it anyway.
Yeah.
And then he starts to ask the question of, you know, why did he have to die? And there he acknowledges, you get into this thing that we call theories of atonement, which I think we've done an episode on before.
Yes.
But I love his explanation of it. He's got this line where he says, theories about Christ's death are not Christianity. Rather, they are explanations about how it works.
Yeah.
Because we can get so caught up on that this is Christianity, and a theoretical explanation about how it works, you know, and I love that he points out this is not Christianity.
Yep.
Explanation, our best explanation that we can get from the text about how it works.
Yeah, and he's actually tested on that in Narnia, the stone table.
Yeah.
And you see which one he selects.
Well, I've argued with you a little bit on this before. I think there's a couple in there on the stone table.
I think he's able to to synergize the various pictures which the scriptures describe with the atonement.
I mean, you do for certain get penal substitution.
That was my only point.
Yeah, you certainly for sure get that, but you also get a little bit of some of the, you know, a little bit of maybe Christus Victor in there too.
For sure, an overthrow of the queen.
I think, and
an army who marches.
And when you look in Mere Christianity here, as he explains it, he kind of went in his explanation focuses on those two for the most part.
Well, Luther did that too,
right? Yeah. Flushes those out, so I think it's not surprising to see both of them in some way in his. Literary writings.
I mean, not to get too off track, but I think this has been part of the problem with that the language, at least in Lutheranism, has been like theories of atonement, and then you have to pick a side instead of saying, what are the biblical presentations here?
Yeah, it's only fair to say there are several in the New Testament text.
And
How about, is it fair to say where he goes a little bit further to say no explanation will ever quite be quite adequate to the reality? I think it is.
I think it is too.
I mean, because I think going back to maybe a previous episode, when we go beyond how the script, you know, just sort of listing out the ways that the scripture describes it and saying, okay, scripture most often speaks this way, penal substitution, but it also speaks this way.
Yep.
Any other attempt to say that, you know, this is it, this is the only one, that's really a peeking behind the curtain.
Yes, I agree.
Which,
if they're set there in the New Testament text, respect them.
Yeah.
Kneel.
And we see, I mean, too, the problem with sin is, you know, there's not just one problem with sin, right? It affects earthly relationships. It affects your status before God. You've enslaved yourself to the devil. There's multiple problems that have to be solved for. So it makes sense that the entirety of the scriptures solves for all of those problems.
Yeah. I think 1 out of 100 in our day would be able to lay that down. You know, the old Westerns where somebody talks as if he's certainly going to hell. And if you could insert into the scripture somebody from the crowd saying, why do you think you're going there? And I know what the movie answer would be. You know, it'd be drinking and smoking and
all the men
womanizing.
Shot.
And
all
the men I've shot.
Yeah.
But it's basically the wrong answer.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, so we have one chapter left and only, you know, a couple minutes left to the show. So, and this one is just it's a conclusion chapter, right? The practical conclusion. So, and I think works as a continuation of the last chapter that ends at atonement stuff, right? It kind of goes to what's the result of the atonement.
And it's the theme of that a new kind of life has been put in you. Something has been added to you that's been gone for a whole long time.
Yeah, I like this in Heidelberg and even Ferdy's explanation of the end of Heidelberg, that God creates what is pleasing to him, and so he recreates the mm-hmm. sinner into the believer.
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I definitely think that's present here in Lewis as well, this this creation. And he mentions this with baptism and faith and the Lord's Supper
yep.
as well, too.
I think it's this chapter where he goes too far into being a free will theologian at the very end when he starts talking about your ability to free, he's delaying his second coming, and he's holding off. We can guess that he's holding off so that those who are in his army have decided to be there freely on their own, you know, that type of thing. But it's so interesting with all the other places where he talks about being brought into it, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's again, to give him the benefit of the doubt, I just don't think it's... I think it's evangelical speaking in a sense, where you might go out and when you're evangelizing, before you're catechizing, you know, really just tell people that they need to believe, right?
Yeah.
You need to
believe. Oh, absolutely.
And in their mind, they're going to, the conclusion is probably that they're freely choosing of themselves to believe. And after they come to the cross, right, the months after that, you'll be catechizing them into the faith, which will show them
mm-hmm, they were brought in.
That they were brought in. So yep. I think if you see this as a very evangelical document on its own, where he's reaching out to unbelievers, it's not absurd to speak that way.
Yeah. And I said to Missouri guys, if you're going to tell me that my theology can't let me say to somebody, believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved, you and your family,
you're not.
Then there's something wrong with your theology.
That's right. Your theology is not of the New Testament.
All I'm doing is quoting the Bible, and I think well.
Yep. I think so, too.
Well, it doesn't fit the system.
Yeah, I mean, at Concordia, actually, in the doctrine classes that I had, Dr. Mueller was very emphasized this quite a bit, actually, that you're going to have a lot of people who say, I believed, and it's not going to be your job to immediately attack them on this. You're going to be right. happy that they're in your church.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was an...
Good
was
for important. Steve.
It was important. Anything else we should add on this?
You'll enjoy it if you read it.
Yeah, I think so. I think you need to know that.
Yeah, I mean, book two again, I think... We picked this because it's important. We've done like three or four episodes on books that we think are important. We've done episodes on the Small and Large Catechism. We've done things within the Book of Concord. We've done the Formula of Concord. We've done the Augsburg Confession, the Apology. We're not saying this is a confessional document, right?
No.
But we're saying this is worth reading, and that's why we're outlining it.
Good Christian reading, and Lewis will provide that over and over and over and over.
So thank you for listening to this episode. This is part two of what will be three eventually, because there is a closing book here that we're going to eventually do probably next month. So once again, thank you for listening. Thank you for encouraging us to do episodes like this. And please do look out for future episodes where we cover chapters and books and the like. We'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.